Thank you for inviting me to make this talk on your seminar. So I'll explain some constructions relating the homological mirror symmetry and direct categories to make these direct categories probably more popular. I'll try to make some sort of introduction. So suppose we have and look on the Earth, which we consider as a sphere. And in fact, for me, it will be important to consider it as a CP1, the projective complex projective line. Then, because I consider it a complex projective line, the geometry of this variety, as a complex variety, will be described by means of direct category. So if X is a general complex or algebraic, complex algebraic variety, then the geometry of it is described by direct category of coherent sheaves over X. So this means coherent, B means that it's bounded. So it's a category of complexes of sheaves, of coherent sheaves over X with bounded homology. So in this case, when X is CP1, there is actually not so many objects in this category. Actually, any indecomposable objects in DB on CP1 any indecomposable object is either a structure sheaf of a point, so where X is a point from here, or a line bundle L, which on the projective space is on I, enumerated by one integer I. So if we want to describe geometry by means of this category, we can imagine that, say, if you have a country here, then we can put many points, approximate the country by points xi, and assign to this country an object which is the direct sum of xi over these points. Summation is taken over this, over when I runs, xi runs over the number of points. So this is an object in this category, and in this sense we can approximate geometry of the variety by objects of the category. Of course, all these objects are actually in the abelian category of coherent sheaves over X, this and this. So actually, the decomposable object in the direct category is described by as this object and their twists. So it's OXI twisted by, shift. Any direct category is a triangulated category. So there is a shift functor, which in the direct category denoted by T, which in direct category is just the shift of the gradient of the complexes. So any indecomposable object is actually a shift. So iterated shift is denoted by this square brackets. So it's OXI and L and O on J, say, and O on I with the shift J. So this is the description of all indecomposable objects in direct category of coherent sheaves over CP1. It's simple. It's the simplest situation because usually, when X of dimension greater than one, then objects in this category, indecomposable objects, could be very complicated. They are not. They are not concentrated in the one graded component like this one. Now, there is a description of this direct category in the different terms. The reason why we consider direct categories, it's well, it's more or less, at the moment, it's somehow heuristic. I mean, yeah, experience shows that this derived category has somehow better behavior than corresponding abelian categories of sheaves. There is, well, some explanation from string theory, and there is some explanation from topology, but I don't think we really have good explanation for why we should consider derived categories. Now, but at least one of the reasons is that sometimes these derived categories have completely different description. In particular, if you have derived category of one variety of a variety X of coherent sheaves, it could be identified with derived category of modules over some, say, finite dimensional algebra A. So it's representations of some finite dimensional algebra. In this particular case of CP1, this algebra, there is an algebra like this. I mean, not for any variety we have such an algebra, but for some we do. And so for CP1, this algebra A of CP1 looks like this. It's an algebra of the paths of the quiver. The algebra could be geometrically described as a quiver with two points and two arrows. The meaning of this is the following. To any point, we assign a projector in the algebra. So let it 0, 1, alpha, and beta. So we have two projectors, P1 and P0, orthogonal projectors. So we have usual relations that P0 square is P0, P1 square is P1, and P0, P1, P1, P0 is 0. And also we have elements in this algebra corresponding to the arrows, so alpha and beta. And this structure of the quiver explains us how to multiply this alpha and beta and P0, P1. In particular, say alpha P0 is alpha because alpha starts from 0, but alpha P1 is 0 because alpha starts from 0 and ends in 1. But because it ends in 1, P1 alpha is 0, is alpha, and so on. And the product of... So the point is that we will have more general quivers like this with multiple arrows. And whenever we have some alpha and some beta here, the product is 0 unless these two arrows are composable. And composable means that it looks like this. So alpha beta is not could be non-zero only if they are composable, meaning the target of the first arrow is the end, is the source of the second one. I mean, though sometimes we also consider quivers to be the relations, meaning that the corresponding in the corresponding algebra is the path, actually the path algebra of the quiver. So this was the simplest the description of the path algebra of the simplest quiver. So whenever you have a quiver, you take all paths in this quiver, and you make composition in the same way by adjoining this path. And you also can put some relations on this quiver. We'll see on examples how it happens, say, for CP2. But for this particular algebra, it's an algebra of dimension 4 with these four generators as a linear space. I mean, this algebra, in this case, is generated by these four elements with relations like this. And we should consider modules over this algebra. And modules over the algebra of a quiver is actually a representation of this quiver, meaning that we have here should have 20 20 vertex, we should assign a vector space v0 and v1 in this case, and to every arrow we should assign a linear map from one space to the other. And of course, if we have more complicated query like this, then the representation is a sequence of spaces and maps. And if you have relations in this query, say that we could have a relation like this, alpha beta is equal to gamma beta. Because, I mean, in principle, these are free generators in the path algebra, but we can equate some paths. Then, when we write here maps representing these arrows, so we have corresponding maps, then for this maps we should put, of course, the same relation. So this is the definition of representations of the query, and it's exactly the same as the modules over the corresponding path algebra of the query. So in this particular case for P1, this is a representation is just two vector spaces and two morphisms. As I said, we have identification only, it's also bounded direct category, only for direct categories, not for the abelian ones. The abelian category of coherent sheaves of CP1 is not equivalent to representations of this query, but direct categories are. Pardon?
When can you find such an algebra whose derived category of modules coincides with the...
It happens when? You mean under which conditions? Well, I'm going to speak on this. I mean, it's just the first example. It's not always possible. Long story. This is a representation of the query. And as I said, there is an equivalence. In particular, all these objects could be presented by some representations of the queries. For example, the structure sheaf of a point OX is given by a representation which has K is the complex one-dimensional vector space, and these two arrows, one of them is representing, it's two numbers, right? Just say the same. I will denote them by the same alpha and beta. And so we can use one of them, say alpha, to identify these two vector spaces. I mean, these are maps. Generally, these two spaces are not identified. But we do identify, say, if alpha is non-zero, then we can identify these two spaces by alpha. And then beta is a morphism from the space to itself. I mean, it's a matrix. What I mean is actually that what do matters is beta alpha minus 1. This is because we consider representations up to isomorphism of representations. The only value which matters in the representation is this number. It's just a complex number. But, of course, if alpha is 0, then we got the infinity. So, in fact, this element takes values in CP1. And this element is exactly this point X. So to OX, we assign some object like this, and in such a way that beta and alpha satisfy this condition, that X is beta alpha minus 1. So it means, for example, if X infinity, then it means that alpha is represented by 0 and beta by any constant. Yeah, it works. Right. Yeah. It doesn't matter, actually. It would matter for the pictures which I will describe, I guess, in the second part of my talk, but at that moment, it could work. You could take any field of any characteristic, at least for the case of CPM. Okay. You know, about your question, how we can generalize it. It's actually this functor which we got here. Yeah, maybe I also should say that if you take line bundle OI, then it's well, it's represented by more complicated representation of this quiver. More precisely, it's these two vector spaces V0 and V1. V1 are as vector spaces. The first one is of dimension I. Well, let us be OK. The corresponding quiver has CK here, and CK plus 1 here over the second vertex. And morphisms are like this. So we take some base in this vector space CK, so it's E1 EK. Then the first map, alpha, is given, and also the base here, EK plus 1. Then the first one is given by this sort of map. I mean, just take EI to EI, and the other one is like this one. Of course, here K should be greater than 0, and we know that OK exists for negative Ks as well, but that's because of the right category. For negative K, there is a sort of shift, so O on negative K is represented by quiver with which is a representation of the quiver which is shifted by 1 in the derived category. So it's actually represented by a quiver where you have CK plus 1 here, CK here. So maps goes, so it, we have E1, EK plus 1. Here is E1, EK. So now this second guy has dimension 1. Less by 1 than the first one. So the first map goes like this. I mean, this is alpha, and this is beta here. So here alpha is horizontal, and beta, meaning that this last vector goes to 0 for alpha, and for beta, it goes this way. Pardon? Yes, and E1 goes to 0. Thank you. Right. So, but as I said, it's some representation which we can denote, I don't know, MK. And now, actually, all minus K goes not to MK, but to MK shifted by 1 or minus 1, something like that. Plus minus 1, I don't remember exactly. Because it's equivalence of direct categories. So it's actually the theorem. This is Birghoff and Grothendieck theorem that all in the composable objects look like this. And here we have this quiver is called Kronecker quiver. And the theory of decomposable representations of this quiver, that all of them are given either by this, either by this quiver or by this representations or by this, it's a theorem of Kronecker. So identification of these theorems is under only as I mean in the framework of direct categories. Pardon? All zero. You mean when x is zero? K. This k. It's okay. It's still one dimensional here. Zero, just zero. Zero dimensional vectors. Right. It's okay. It's simple so-called simple representation of the quiver. So to generalize this theory, say at least for CPN. Yeah, so as you could see that, yeah, maybe before generalizing I should say something. So we have here the zero pole, right? And the south pole and the north pole. So, as I said, to these points we also assign this structure shift of points. And under this identification, the structure sheaf of points goes to some particular representations of this sort, right? Where either alpha is zero for one of the poles or beta is zero for the other pole. And to any contrary, we can assign a direct sum of these representations. So here we have one dimensional to at any point, right? Now to a contrary, we assign first the sum of all xi, and this, under this identification of derived categories, is presented by a quiver which has n dimensional vector space over every point and two maps between them. And as I said, I mean, it's a general point that when you have these two vector spaces which are not identified, we'd better write them as v0 and v1, both of dimension n. But if one of the arrows is invertible, then we can identify these two vector spaces by means of alpha, and then beta would be just a map under this identification. Beta is just a map from v0 to itself. In other words, we take beta alpha minus 1 as an endomorphism of v0. So it's just a matrix. So a country is represented by a matrix. And when you take more points in the country, it means that you take more, the dimension of this vector space is bigger and bigger. And this, if you go the other way around, it's more or less the matrix matrix theory, the big M limit of matrix theory in string field theory. You understand what I mean? I mean all this Wigner. Well, whenever you have, yeah, that's correct. Well, using these guys. Okay. Exactly. Well, but if you take this typical matrix integral, it's unitary operators, right? And you care, when you write this, you know, the corresponding theory, you care about eigenvalues of this operator. And these eigenvalues are exactly this. So, of course, you take into account some probability theory, but it's more or less, I mean, the same story. When you, I mean, all this Wigner type of functions is more or less somehow related to the structure of the country. Okay. Now, let's see how we can generalize it to bigger dimension. The way how one constructs this functor, it's actually is there any device? No, just by hand. Is the following. In fact, we can consider arbitrary triangulated category D and define their so-called exceptional collections, which is a sequence of objects E0, EN in the category, satisfying the following property that X from EI to EJ, well, XK from EI to EI is zero for any I and K not equal zero, and home from EI to EI is our field C, or we can also define it in arbitrary characteristic. So this is the definition of an exceptional collection. So EI of an exceptional object. And also there is a definition of exceptional collection. So this was a definition of this guy. Now, an exceptional collection is a collection, or exceptional sequence, probably better to say, because it's an ordered sequence. It's when all objects EI are exceptional, and also all X groups from EI to EJ is zero for I greater than J. So it's a sort of semi-orthogonality condition. Maybe also the third definition at this point. And this exceptional collection, well, it's called full if this object generates this triangulated category. It means that the minimal strictly full triangulated subcategory containing these objects generate the whole category, coincides with the whole category. Full if, so I will denote it like this, E0 EN, and it would mean that the minimal strictly full triangulated subcategory generated by this object, and it should coincide with our category D. So it's a full exceptional, if you have a full exceptional collection, well, it's also called strong exceptional collection or sequence. Well, anyway, it's maybe alt. Strong if there is also all X groups in this in the other direction, X K from EI to EJ is zero when K is not equal to zero for any K. So if you look on this exceptional collection, we can see exceptional objects are exceptional, meaning there is no X groups from these objects to themselves. So this condition, exceptional sequence, means that there is no X groups in the negative direction, and only X in this positive direction. And the strong means that only in the positive direction we have only homomorphisms. And this is how we construct our quiver, actually. Whenever we have a full exceptional collection, we can construct an algebra A, which is just the endomorphism algebra of the object, which is the sum of all these EIs. And this algebra is actually the path algebra of the quiver. And the quiver is given like this. We have from I to I plus I, from I to J, we write the algebra of Holmes. These arrows are is the basis in the algebra of Holmes from EI to EJ. Well, when we write a quiver, we can write less number of arrows for the reason that actually some arrows are composition of the others. So let me, the exceptional collection, but let me first formulate general theorem, and it's like this, that if you have a strong, full exceptional collection, so if EI strong and full and exceptional, then there is an equivalence of this triangulated category, the direct category of modules over this algebra A. So in this particular case of P1, this exceptional collection is actually just O and O1. And then the algebra is the algebra of this quiver. So it's just an instance of this theorem. Now, for CPN, an exceptional collection, which we will consider. Well, we also could take here O and O minus 1, actually. The algebra of the quiver is the same. So I think for me it would be more convenient to use the collection which goes O minus N minus N plus 1, so on up to O. So it's a full exceptional collection, so this theory is applicable. This theorem. And for CPN, in particular, for CP2, the algebra of this algebra A of endomorphism of the sum of this object could be presented as a path algebra of the quiver with three vertices, three arrows from alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3, and three arrows here, beta 1, beta 2, beta 3, and relations that beta I alpha j is beta j alpha I. So it's a quiver with relations. So say if we consider paths from 0 to 2, then we have 9 paths, right? Beta j alpha I. But we have 3 relations, and it means that the number of morphisms from the 0 object to the second object is 6-dimensional, right? And the six-dimensional space is exactly the space of homomorphism from O. So in this case, it's O minus 2, O minus 1, and O. So homomorphism from O minus 2 to O is just the second, if projective space was the projectivization of some vector space, then this is global sections. This is identified the global sections of ON2, which is that is just the second symmetric power S square on Vistra of the dual space to the one which we projectivized. And this is, of course, of dimension 6. If this is P2, then V is of dimension 3. And S square of V, 3, is of dimension 6. And it's exactly the path in this quiver. The path in the quiver makes the base for this vector space. Okay. Now, unfortunately, this exceptional collection do not exist in arbitrary projective variety, but there is a conjecture. So suppose X is a smooth projective variety. Say over the complex numbers at this moment, though might it doesn't matter. Neither. Then consider the Hodge numbers H I J on X. Conjecture is that, and suppose X is funnel, meaning that the anticanonical class of X is positive, ample bundle, then suppose that the Hodge diamond is supported on the diagonal, meaning that Hij is 0 when I is not equal to J. So say for CP2, it looks like this. C, 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 and zeros here, right? So CPN satisfies this condition in particular. Then, conjecturally, and it actually should be equivalent, conjecturally, the direct category of X has a full strong. Well, no, no, just full exceptional collection. It could be in principle non-strong. It might be has a full, a strong as well. Actually, theory has a generalization to non-strong exceptional collections, where instead of algebra, one should consider the DG algebra of endomorphisms. But theory is a little bit more complicated. So this is actually quite strong condition. Whenever you have the intermediate Jacobian is non-trivial, then it's certainly not satisfied. For curves, this condition is satisfied. Well, the only funny curve is CP1, of course. So even this condition is satisfied only for CP1, and of course this one as well. For in dimension 2, for funny varieties, I mean del Pezzo surfaces, this condition is always satisfied. But in bigger dimension, it's not. And I mean this is quite a strong condition. So these are restrictions of this approach by exceptional collections. But one can actually... Yeah, maybe it would be. I mean, one can generalize this theory to so-called semi-orthogonal decompositions. I maybe I'll say a few words on this. So this condition, this one, of exceptionality of the sequence, it's a sort of semi-orthogonal condition on this sequence of objects, right? That in one direction all X groups are trivial. It could be generalized in the following sense. Suppose we have a triangulated category D and the sequence of subcategory, an ordered sequence of subcategories in this category D. Then we call it a semi-orthogonal sequence if home groups, these are triangulated subcategories so from DI to DJ, is zero for I greater than j. Whenever we have an exceptional collection, we have the sequence of subcategories di, where di is the category generated by one particular exceptional object of the sequence. And because it's exceptional, this category is actually equivalent to direct category of module of vector spaces. Complex vector spaces. It's exactly the condition of exceptionality of an object which gives this. So whenever we have an exceptional collection, we get such a semi-orthogonal sequence where all categories are direct categories of vector spaces. But there are some more general semi-orthogonal decompositions, sequences. Well, we call such a sequence a semi-orthogonal decomposition if it's generate the whole category D in the same sense as in the case of exceptional collections, meaning that the minimal strictly full minimal triangulated full triangulated subcategory in D, which contains all these subcategories DI, coincides with the whole D. Meaning that it's somehow complete or full sequence. Mirror symmetry suggests that such a decomposition should exist. I mean, there should be some canonical decomposition like this. Canonical meaning that up to, I should say that there is an action of the Braid group on these semi-orthogonal sequences. So Braid group in N strings, Bn, acts on semi-orthogonal sequences in a given category D. In particular, it also acts on the Braid group acts on exceptional collections. And this action, and it seems that, I mean, it's another conjecture, which is, that one I think I figured out about 15 years ago. And this, there is a sort of, should be a sort of extension of this conjecture, which is probably not so precisely formulated. But the point is that there should be some canonical semi-orthogonal decomposition of any derived category of coherent sheaves on, well, at least on a Fano variety. Well, but probably even for any x. So there exists a canonical semi-orthogonal decomposition. And canonical means up to the action of the braid group, because a braid group acts, you don't have just one decomposition, it's not unique. But up to this action, there should exist some canonical decomposition. How many pieces? No. No conjecture. No. Well, we'll see how it's related to mirror symmetry later. No.
No.
Well, Euler number, by Euler number, do you mean the rank of the of K0? Or? No. Oh, I don't know what do you mean by Euler. Maybe you mean another Euler.
Euler, no, not Euler. The dimension of the homology.
Ah.
That's the sum of that.
No, it's not. No, no. No. It's more complicated.
Condition, do you get Fano and...
Well, it's Fano we should put in the parentheses. It doesn't matter, I guess. But no. Yes. Oh, even in this case. Right. Well, I mean, yes, it's. I mean, it's a related story, of course, but. This is somehow, it's a little bit different. Well, I'd better say on this later, okay. Well, but you're right that if we have this condition, then, I mean, this exceptional collection, its length coincides with the rank of K0.
Yes. Which is the same.
Which is the same as the sum of the dimensions HII. That's correct. That's true, yeah. And this is the number of elements in the exceptional collection.
Okay.
All right. Do you call this Euler number?
Okay.
I don't think so. Well, in this particular case, yeah, you're right. In this case, it is right. Well, but you know, this say in the case of Calabi-Yau, this conjecture is somehow trivial. You have a decomposition, but this decomposition is just the X itself. I mean, but for varieties of general type, when the canonical class is positive, you still, I think there should exist a canonical semi-orthogonal decomposition. Mirror symmetry somehow suggests this. And it's not always trivial. Okay. Yes. Yeah, as I said, this second conjecture is not so precise. It's... there is some canonical decomposition, but somehow you can take dx itself as a decomposition. And you should, if it's Calabi-Yau variety. But still, I mean, there should exist some canonical decomposition, which is not all. It's not a precise conjecture. It's not mathematical. It's physical conjecture, I would say. Of first. Oh, yes. In one direction, I can prove it, actually. I forgot to say, in this direction. If you have an exceptional collection, then these guys are trivial. Yeah, it's a theory of invariance of triangulated categories, which became popular now. But it, pardon? I think even if it's not strong, right? It's still correct. Though probably I don't quite know how to prove it in this case. Yeah, but yeah, I think it's true. Yes, sorry. No. It's just I put this conjecture. Sometimes you have exceptional collection on non-finite varieties as well. It's not the final version of the conjecture. It's just some strictly formulated, mathematically formulated. And the most general version should be like this, but we don't know what this, how. I mean, it's just some indication there should be some construction, but what should be properties which uniquely identify this construction, we don't yet know. Okay, so the point of my talk is actually, it was just the introductory section, it started from some observation that the direct category of coherent shifts on CP1 could be identified with direct category of constructible shifts, not coherent like here. I mean, these coherent shifts, they describe the so-called complex geometry of varieties in the sense of Italian school of algebraic geometry of the beginning of 20th century and maybe end of the 19th. But there is another sort of shift on Actually, it will be on some differential geometric varieties. So it's a manifold, not usually called. M would be some real analytic. Even this is not important. It's just a topological, right? A topological manifold. Well, but in my case, it will be just a real dimensional torus. So it will be S1 to N. I'll denote it by Tn or just T. And this shifts, I will explain what sort of shifts I mean, but shifts on this torus will be constructible. Excuse me? Here it's CPM. Well, I'll start from example. But in general, let's start from CP1. Then this is just a circle, S1. And and there will be some stratification, well, which I probably denote by S, of this torus. So stratifications. Stratification of some such a manifold M. I first should explain what is the right hand side, right? So M is a real analytic manifold, and stratifications which I consider on it, stratification means that this M is presented as a disjoint union of some strata. Si. Yes. A strata which I will consider will actually be of the sort like this. We have some real analytic functions, fi and gj, some finite number of functions, and we put restrictions like fi is less than zero for oi. Gj are less than or equal zero for all j. this would give me my strata. Inequalities like this. In the particular case of the circle S1, there will be two strata. One is the interval, a closed interval, so with the boundary, a strata like this, and the other strata is an open interval. So the other one, it looks like this. Now, so whenever you have a stratification like this, well, there is also some technical conditions of the stratifications which I would like to suppress. Now, a constructible sheaf is first of all of a sheaf, so we can there is a variety of constructible sheaves on this M subordinated by this stratification S. I mean this stratification. And it means the following. We consider sheaves on M, first of all. The sheaves should be locally constant on the strata. It means that when you have some strata Si and it's embedding into M, say alpha I, then, well, this alpha I has nothing to do with dots. Then the inverse image of our sheaf over M should be locally constant. On strata, on the strata Si. And then we consider the direct category of sheaves on our M, on M with a constructible cohomology, constructible with respect to a given stratification. So let's see how it looks. Yeah, so the first observation is that this direct category of coherent sheaves over CP1 is identified with the category of sheaves on the circle with respect to the stratification with two strata. F is a sheaf on M. Well, what is a sheaf? Probably I should recall. Sheaf is the following guy. Whenever you have some open set in M, you assign to it some vector space, F on U. Sheaf of vector spaces. Right. Well, actually, coherent sheaf is also a sheaf of vector spaces with some additional structure. But this structure makes this sheaf, the nature of those sheaves, of coherent sheaves, somehow algebraic, some algebraic or complex geometric nature. And these sheaves are more of topological nature. So to any open, we assign a vector space, and to any embeddings of two opens, you should assign a map from F on U to F on V, which satisfies a lot of conditions. In our case, so as I said, it should be locally constant. What is a locally constant sheaf? It's actually a sheaf which is isomorphic to the constant sheaf locally. So on some opens U in the strata S, this sufficiently small open subspace, the sheaf F on U should be just isomorphic to C. So this vector space should be one-dimensional. For coherent sheaves, usually this sheaf has a lot of, sheaves are, say, sheaves of sections of some coherent sheaf. Usually they are of big dimension. Just see. Oh, yeah, yeah, to any, right, sorry. Excuse me? Okay. In particular, if stratum is contractible, then locally free sheaths on it are locally constant sheaths on Fi is the same as just constant sheaths. And constant sheaf means that to any open U, you assign this the same vector space, and all morphisms are just identity morphisms. So when I said locally, it means that I should be more precise. Actually, locally constant means the following. We have an open set in S, right? And on this open set, this sheaf should be isomorphic to the constant sheaf. Means that for any open V here, we have FV, which is identified with the same vector space CN for any V. It's just the same vector space. And when we have V1 and V2, two open sets, one of which is embedded in the other one, then we have this identification with CN here and here, and the restriction morphism should be the identity morphism. This means that on this open U, the restriction of our sheaf F to U, F restricted to U, is isomorphic to the constant sheaf Cn on U. And as I said, if the strata are contractible, then locally, whenever you have a variety, a manifold which is contractible, then locally constant sheaves on this manifold is the same as it's just constant sheaves. But then we consider this derived category. It means that we consider complexes of arbitrary sheaves on M with bounded homology, and this homology sheaves should be constructible, which makes theory a little bit more complicated. But in the case which, there are some conditions on the strata which will be satisfied in my case, when actually this guy will be identified with constructible sheaves, with the direct category of the abelian category of constructible sheaves. So in the case of CP1, as I said, stratification is like this, and sheaves could be considered as follows. We have some vector space over this interval, say I'll denote it by I, and the other interval, an open interval without boundary, will be denoted by, say, this is S1 and this is S2. So because it's locally constant over S1, then we can assign actually some vector space V1, which is this vector space over this open subset. And we also have something over this V2. In particular, we have the structure sheaf of the open strata, S1. This S1 as S2, they have two embeddings in our circle, which is S upper one, right? We have structure sheaf, the constant sheaf, or not structure, constant sheaf on the strata, S1 and S2, CS1 and CS2, and we can embed them into this category of constructible sheaves on S1. Meaning that we take this maps alpha 1 and alpha 2. And we take this constructible sheaves pushed forward on S1. So sheaves actually in this category, they are alpha 1 low star and alpha 2 low star. I mean, these sheaves are on these spaces, S1 and S2, and we can push forward them. And this actually is an exceptional collection. These two guys, so let's denote them, these sheaves L1 and L2, then they have one X, I think, from L2 to L1. Not one, two-dimensional X group. This two-dimensional, the base in this vector space is given by the ends of this interval, so to speak. It's actually not the exceptional collection which actually I'm interested in. There is another one which somehow matters better to what I'm going to explain later. When let's consider again this circle with this interval, and so we still consider this S1, which mapped by alpha 1. Yeah, maybe I'll denote this by beta. Alpha 1 and beta. So this is S1, and there will be another. Yeah, and maybe this not S2, but I don't know, S beta. Sorry. So, and S2 will be another interval, also closed, but like this. This will be S2. And we have two maps. One is the embedding of S1 into the circle, and the other one is the alpha 2 will be this embedding. Then we take the constant sheaf again, CS1, push it forward by means of alpha 1. This will be some object E0, E1, I guess. And also we take alpha 2 star of CS1, and this is E2. And I claim that this is an exceptional collection, and homomorphism of this exceptional collection is exactly the same. I mean, it's two-dimensional, there is no other X groups. So this allows us to identify these two categories by means of exceptional collection, meaning that we have derived category of coherent sheaves on CP1. We identified it with derived category of modules of algebra of the Creeler, and we can identify the same category with direct category of constructible sheaves on S1 with this stratification F. Because this category and this category, they have full, strong exceptional collections with the same algebra A, which is the algebra of this Creeler. So it's a sort of observation. So in the second part of my talk, I will explain how to generalize this to higher dimension and how it's related to mirror symmetry. And this is going to be a joint project with Wei Dong Ran. Would you like to make a break? I mean, it's up to you. Maybe, right, yeah, maybe I'll continue. Okay. 5 minute break. Yeah, I think 5 minutes.
Okay.
Huh? Oh, la la. как-то вот